You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the February 2019 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. This Vanity Fair spotlight is by Dorota Leck, In From the Cold. Photograph by Reuven Afanador, styled by Anatoly Smith. All's Fair, Joanna Kulig, photographed in New York City. After the Cannes premiere of Pavel Polakowski's Cold War, the entire auditorium burst into applause, and almost everyone turned to the seat occupied by the person whose face was projected on the 19-by-8-meter screen. Polish actress Joanna Kulig, who sat with her face buried in her hands. 3 years after his drama Ida became the first Polish movie to win the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film, Polakowski has returned with Cold War, a desperate love story shot in monochrome, set in a divided post-war Poland, and co-starring Kulig. "She has an aura and light," says Polakowski, who wrote his new film with the actress in mind. On camera, Kulig's power is in her range. The part of Zula, a country girl ingenue, spans 15 years and innumerable transformations, which Kulig navigates with remarkable agility. Polakowski is widely heralded as the most exciting Polish filmmaker working today. Though his film Ida has been criticized by members of Poland's leading right-wing Law and Justice Party, the director's success, however, has been a beacon of hope for Poles who despair at the country's tilt toward authoritarianism, and so has Kulig's. Like her character in Cold War, Kulig, who will soon welcome her first child with her director husband, Maciej Bochniak, hails from a small town in Poland. "Being from the countryside gave me a spine," she says. "It's also why I'm so accepting." Kulig, who was born in 1982, doesn't remember the rule of communism, which weighs so heavily on her character. "But I think about my grandmother and mother and how hard it was for them," she says. "Poland is a country of strong women." tricks of his trade. Donald Trump has long leveraged bias in order to win big. Building the business of his flashy Florida club was just the beginning, writes Lawrence Lehmer. Opening photo, huge vibrations. Marla Maples, Donald Trump, and Maples' mother, Laura Ann Locklear, enjoy a Beach Boys concert at Trump's newly rechristened Mar-a-Lago, 1996. This article is from Mar-a-Lago, Inside the Gates of Power at Donald Trump's Presidential Palace, by Lawrence Lehmer. Copyright 2019 by the author and reprinted by permission of Flatiron Books. During the 1980s, Donald Trump had strutted across the American landscape, boastful, flamboyant, the Liberace of real estate. But by the early 90s, he was so over-leveraged that when one piece after another of his holdings did not perform at a high enough level to service his massive debt, the whole Jerry-built empire began to totter. He bankrupted both Trump's Taj Mahal Casino in Atlantic City and the Plaza Hotel in New York, and was close to losing the heavily mortgaged Mar-a-Lago. Trump loved Mar-a-Lago so much that he was willing to do almost anything to hold on to it, says his former Palm Beach lawyer Paul Rample. Trump petitioned the town to build 8 homes on the 17-acre property, but was so disliked in the resort community that he was turned down. That led him to the idea of turning the massive grounds, once the home of Marjorie Meriwether Post, into a private club. Mar-a-Lago held its grand opening in December 1995. The theme was déjà vu. Trump recreated an evening in the late 20s when the estate had been the scene of the most exclusive social events in the wealthy resort community. To foster Trump's fantasy, 20 workers spent 6 months turning the ballroom into a black and silver cabaret from the jazz age. That evening, a moon would be shining down on the formally dressed guest gathered around the swimming pool, but Trump wanted to light up the scene like day itself, and he brought in 72,000 watts of additional lighting. Parked along the intracoastal waterway were vintage Packard automobiles, another nod to the Roaring Twenties. Next photos, court gesture. Trump plays at the Mar-a-Lago Pro-Am Tournament 2000 and the 128-room estate on 17 acres. The club had actually been open to members since April, but Trump wanted a spectacular evening to shine attention on his accomplishment and lift him even higher in the mass consciousness. "People can't believe how many members we have," Trump told a Palm Beach Daily News reporter, looking out on the 350 members and guests. "The place sells itself." Trump believed that boasting about hundreds of Palm Beachers throwing their checks at him would cause a stampede for memberships. His enemy was always the literal truth, and what he was saying wasn't quite what had happened. Despite Trump's assertion that he had initially charged $50,000, doubling the amount to $100,000 after the informal opening, most of the first 100 members paid $25,000. The money had been kept in escrow, and if the club never opened, they would have gotten their money back. For some, it was cheaper than that. "I had half a dozen clients that didn't pay to get in," said CPA Richard Rample, whose brother Paul was Trump's attorney. Trump comped them because he thought that they would bring in other people. Trump gave one man free membership in return for carpeting and cut almost as many different deals as there were members. For all his braying and boasting, Trump needed to attract new members who would shell out major money, and this showy gala was one way to do it. Trump was still rising out of a financial debacle that included four business bankruptcies and a sale of many of his assets. Half of his body was out of the quicksand, but the other half was still there, says one early member. Several New Yorkers warned me not to join. They said Trump was going down, taking Mar-a-Lago with him. The invitees entered the driveway past a gauntlet of cameramen filming for CNN, Fox, and other television outlets. No one else but Trump could have gotten national television networks to cover a party promoting a private club, but there they were. As the guests arrived through the main gates, they were serenaded by a row of violinists culled from classical musicians in South Florida, and as new arrivals entered the mansion, waiters offered cocktails, flutes of champagne, and hors d'oeuvres. The guest moved outside, where professional dancers dressed as flappers and their bows danced the Charleston. Once guests filled their plates with fresh jumbo shrimp, filet mignon, and lobster in a pastry shell, they sat down at tables around the pool. For dessert, there was a deliciously tart lemon tart, a rich chocolate mousse cake, and other pastries so beautiful that it seemed a pity to eat them. After dinner, the crowd flowed into the ballroom. The room was not large enough for everyone, so those who could not squeeze in watched on screens set up on the lawn as the cabaret singer Karen Akers climbed atop the grand piano. Akers' songs evoked feelings of the long-gone era. Afterward, on the veranda, Tony Bennett sang a few more songs. Trump wore black tie and walked through the party alongside Marla Maples Trump, who wore a beaded flapper-like gown, elbow-length white gloves, and an ivory headpiece from the 20s. Trump greeted one guest after another, never stopping for long, moving on with nervous intensity, and then moving on again, rarely letting anyone touch him. It was a scene out of The Great Gatsby, the Palm Beach Daily News began its front-page story on the gala. It was natural to compare Trump to F. Scott Fitzgerald's greatest creation, and Trump may have planned the evening with that in mind. He did not have Gatsby's mysterious aura, but he did share Fitzgerald's description of the character in that there was some heightened sensitivity to the promises of life. Trump also possessed Gatsby's restless quality, as described by Fitzgerald. He was never quite still. There was always a tapping foot somewhere, or the impatient opening and closing of a hand. Trump had begun to claim that the club was his idea, even though it was very much the vision of Paul Rampell, who told Trump there was room on the island for a new club open to everyone. The town of Palm Beach is probably about half Christian and half Jewish, Rampell said. There are five clubs. Four of those clubs are restricted. No Jews, no African Americans. A majority of the members were Jewish, but there were many Christian members. At the party, the two groups melded seamlessly, and for that alone, the evening was a seminal event in Palm Beach history. On his Palm Beach weekends, Trump almost always played tennis. Rare was the opponent who challenged Trump's inspired line calls. He used the same approach on the links when the game mattered. In championships, he's a chronic cheater, says one of his caddies. He gave me a ball and said, keep it. If we don't find my ball, drop this one. It's marked the same way. As in his golf game, Trump was willing to do almost anything to make Mar-a-Lago the premier club in Palm Beach. Those early years, it was Camelot on steroids, says one charter member. It was Richie Rich playing with all his toys. Donald was under the gun to make everything first class, and that's what he did. we'd say, "Holy cow, look who Donald has coming." For $120, you had a fabulous buffet dinner and a show with a 50-piece orchestra and a world-class performer like James Brown or The Temptations. Many of the performers stayed around and you could talk to them just like anybody. I had lunch with Tony Bennett once and played tennis with Regis Philbin. Trump and Maples and Baby Tiffany flew down almost every weekend to Mar-a-Lago, instead of staying in a guest room, as Paul Rample had promised to the town council. They took over the suite of rooms that had once been post quarters. Next photo, Gilt Group, Trump, Tony Bennett, Maples, and Tiffany Trump at Mar-a-Lago's Jazz Age-themed Grand Opening Gala, 1995. Trump regularly used Mar-a-Lago to advance his other business interest. He believed that even the fiercest deal-maker could be won over by a visit to the resort. When Trump attempted to build a casino in Florida in association with the Seminole Indians, he brought members of the tribe to Mar-a-Lago and set out on the stage an enormous alligator, a species as familiar to the Native Americans as pigeons were to New Yorkers. The alligator's jaws had been clamped shut with tape, and some of the guests went up and petted the denizen of the Everglades swamps. But Trump was unable to make a deal with Seminoles. It may not have helped that he had reportedly referred to the Pequots of Connecticut as the Michael Jordan Indians and opined that organized crime is rampant on the Indian reservation. As Trump's fortunes began to revive, he faced the painful problem of his parents' slow demise. Fred and Mary Trump were well into their 80s, and neither was doing well. His father had Alzheimer's, and his mother was suffering too. He could have afforded to shuttle his parents off to caregivers, rarely allowing them to interrupt his busy life, but he didn't do that. Every time we flew to Palm Beach, we'd carry Trump's mother up the stairs and set her on a chair in the back of the plane, recalled Mike Donovan, his personal pilot. Then we'd bring his father on board, too, and we'd sit on the tarmac for an hour and a half while Trump talked to his parents. His father couldn't fly. We'd bring him down the ramp and put him in his car, and then we'd take off for Florida, carrying his mother with us. Trump would have done almost anything to have his father fly with him, but Fred Trump's health did not allow it, and it gave him some measure of pleasure just to sit and talk to his son before the plane flew south. Trump enjoyed his weekends in Palm Beach, but Marla couldn't stand parts of her life there. The very things her husband loved about the estate appalled Maples. She sought privacy, but unless she huddled alone with Tiffany in the family quarters, wherever she went, she ran into people. She also wanted a true husband and father, someone she could talk to, and someone who would walk down Fifth Avenue pushing a baby carriage. There was an immense sadness and loneliness about Maples. Like Ivana, Trump's first wife, Marla tried to please her husband by becoming what he wanted. With her apparent guileless innocence, she seemed even younger than she was, always a plus in Trump's book. There weren't many women like this in Trump's world-weary New York scene, and initially he was enchanted. But as his girlfriend and wife, he wanted a decked-out woman for display on his arm. Putting on gowns and going out hosting events and having Harry Winston put jewelry on my hands was always uncomfortable for me. That was me playing a role, Maples told People in 2016. I felt that's what the job called for. And so it did. In the end, the woman Trump loved disappeared, and Marla turned into just another Trump girl. The The Trumps' marriage was soon so troubled that sources close to them say Maples often stayed in Florida when Trump flew up to New York to spend the week. The staff reported seeing Trump on his plane with models. It was clear theirs was not a marriage for the ages. In mid-April 1996, while Marla was still at Mar-a-Lago, the National Enquirer's Wayne Grover called Trump in his New York office. "Look," Grover said, "we've got this story." He knew what Trump's reaction would be, but he had to forge ahead. Marla was caught by the cops under this lifeguard stand on the beach near Delray in the middle of the night having sex with your bodyguard. Trump was disbelieving. The cops might have caught him on the beach. A few miles south of Mar-a-Lago having sex, but not his wife, and not with his employee. "No, no, that's not the way it was," Trump said, as if he had been on the beach that early morning. "God damn it, I'm going to sue you guys for effing lying about this. I'll have your ass 10 times over. Trump and Grover were like an old married couple to whom squabbling had become the preferred means of communication. Grover had felt Trump's wrath many times. The tabloid reporter knew whenever it happened, the best thing was to look Trump in the eye and talk him down from his rage. Grover flew to New York with his editor, Larry Haley, to see if he could make Trump see reason. He wasn't going to be able to hide this forever, and Grover would spin it about as well as it could be spun. Trump wouldn't even see Grover and Haley. He agreed to talk only on the phone. By then, Trump had his tail straight. He made up a bullshit story that Marla was with her girlfriend, Grover says, and they stopped every 15 minutes to call him, and she had to pee real bad, so she went to pee under the lifeguard stand, and the bodyguard was just watching over to make sure nobody came back and caught her. Grover was sure about what had happened because the police officer had come to Grover's house and told him the whole story about catching Marla with 35-year-old Spencer Wagner. The tabloid's lawyers immediately let the publication run a cover story with the headline, "Shock for Trump, Marla Caught with Hunk, Cops Interrupt Late Night Beach Frolic." The piece was carefully written with enough innuendo that readers would conclude that the couple was having sex. It appeared that Marla had done to Trump what Trump had done many times to Ivana, devastating beyond imagination to a man of Trump's macho self-image, and the worst thing about it was that he couldn't do anything. His only choice to avoid endless public humiliation seemed to be to stay married to Marla until the ugly matter blew over. Trump flew down to Palm Beach, where Marla released a statement that she had needed to relieve herself that evening, and Wagner had stood a respectable distance away. Trump's spokesman also issued a statement along the lines of Elvis sightings and Martian invasions. The National Enquirer has once again fabricated a wholly unreliable cover story for this week's issue. Despite having excoriated the National Enquirer for the next week's issue, Trump gave the tabloid an interview where he played the loving husband, loyal and trusting beyond measure. Any man would be shocked to hear his wife was stopped by the police at 4 a.m. with another man on the beach. "But I am not just any man, and Marla is not just any woman. I love Marla, and I trust her." For the first few days, Trump put Wagner up in a house he owned near Mar-a-Lago, where the assistant club manager, Nicholas Nick Leone, Jr., brought him food. Then one day, when Leone took Wagner a meal, he discovered that the bodyguard was gone. A few months later, Wagner sold his story to one of the National Enquirer's competitors, The Globe. After The Globe said he passed a lie detector test, the tabloid published a front-page story headlined My Secret Affair with Marla. Trump sued Wagner in Palm Beach County Circuit Court, not for libel, but for violating a confidentiality agreement. By all appearances, the bodyguard's life was ruined. Nobody wanted to hire him any longer, and he fell lower and lower. In 2012, he died of a drug overdose in a likely suicide. While Trump continued to portray Marla as a loyal and loving wife, everything irritated him. His club was shackled by onerous rules he had agreed to in order to get the town council to approve it. Rules that the bath and tennis and the Everglades did not have to follow. The Mar-a-Lago club was limited to 500 members. The B&T had nearly twice as many. And events were limited to 390 guests. Trump wanted to go back to the town council to get the rules changed. Paul Rampel cautioned Trump that they should wait 5 years until he had built the membership into a political constituency to support him. Rampel also said that making anti-Semitism a part of their argument with the town council would backfire. Trump didn't listen. He saw the anti-Semitism at the other clubs as a handy bludgeon at his disposal for attacking his enemies. He intended to claim that the only reason his club had such onerous rules was because he allowed Jewish members. By making that argument, he would ensure that even if he didn't get the rules changed, he would have harmed his enemies. Thriving on controversy, he relished going back into the fray, berating the town as a bastion of anti-Semitism, casting a full measure of shame and embarrassment across the community. Trump saw himself as the wronged party, having been singled out with restrictions that didn't apply to the other clubs, and his revenge came from being at the center of what to him was an exhilarating controversy. He enjoyed unsettling the island and dividing it into those who esteemed him and those who loathed him. Rampel was in an untenable position. He thought Trump's approach was wrong in any number of ways, but what could he do? To preserve the relationship, he had to do what his client wanted, but the whole thing was making him increasingly uncomfortable. In the spring of 1996, Trump called the restrictions on his membership numbers discriminatory, unfair, and unconstitutional. "We've always felt that it was discriminatory and very unfair," he said. "I always felt I would bring it up at the appropriate time when the club was a proven success." Next photo, model collector, Trump and a variant Ferrari F50 miniature on a table at Mar-a-Lago, 2000. Many of the rules had been instated for clearly legitimate reasons. Mar-a-Lago was in a part of town that was zoned as residential. People living there feared what increased traffic and noise might mean for their neighborhood. It turned out that the club created almost no problems, and Trump could have gone to the town in a straightforward way and made a strong case that such rules were not needed. But he sought to stain his enemies with charges that would stick. Trump went to war to overturn these restrictions. "Trump rips Palm Beach Jew haters," ran the headline in the New York Post. The story told how Trump not only raged against the so-called anti-Semites, but also had Paul Rampel mail town council members, community leaders, and local journalist videotapes of Gentleman's Agreement, the classic 1947 film about a reporter who pretends he's Jewish to understand anti-Semitism in post-World War II America. "Sending out Gentleman's Agreement was a horrible idea. Horrible," said Robert Moore, the longtime Palm Beach building inspector, who had been supportive of most of Trump's efforts. It had the reverse effect of what he wanted. Trump ended up insulting any number of Palm Beachers, many of them Jewish. William Gutman, an executive committee member of the Palm Beach Civic Association, said that he was deeply offended by the crude effort to interject anti-Semitism into a hearing on a zoning matter. Trump probably fancied himself a version of the film's star, Gregory Peck, fighting the good American fight against discrimination. We proudly have Jewish members, and if I didn't have Jewish members, the Mar-a-Lago Club wouldn't be going through what it's going through with regard to discrimination, he said. Jewish members of the town council had almost always voted as a bloc on any issue that even peripherally involved their religion. That was no longer the case. Alan S. Wyatt, one of the two Jewish councilmen, was Trump's most intransigent foe. Wyatt was not hostile to his religious brethren, but felt that much of what Trump was demanding was wrong. Realizing the danger Wyatt represented, Trump tried to ingratiate himself with the councilman by offering him a free Mar-a-Lago membership and rides on his jet to and from New York. Wyatt always turned them down. On September 16, 1996, the town council debated whether the restrictions on Mar-a-Lago should be removed. The old-fashioned, white-paneled council chambers had a waist-high banister that separated the council members from the 143 seats for the public. It could have been the setting for a New England town meeting. Even though the debate took place at a time of year when there were few people in town, every seat was taken, and at least 70 people stood around the back of the room. As the meeting started, Trump walked to the front of the chambers to address the council. "I'm very proud of what's happened at Mar-a-Lago," he said. "A few of you know that prior to my purchase, we were close to seeing the wreckers ball into the property." That was not true, but to Trump, history was an inventive reconstruction to help him get what he wanted in the present. He also claimed he had saved the estate in a non-discriminatory fashion, a dig at the restricted clubs. When Trump finished, Paul Rampel got up to speak. Like so many people who got close to Trump, Rampel was losing his sense of self and had become his client's one-man clique. Rampel was a restrained man, not given to excess in word or deed, but he had been around Trump enough to know his employees were expected to praise him with accolades so extreme they might have embarrassed Stalin. Rampel began by saying many on the island had become so obsessed with Trump they couldn't see the issues at stake. He said that Trump was a wildly successful businessman, best-selling author, movie star, political activist, television entertainer, and financial genius. "You forgot scratch golfer," said Council President Leslie Smith. "I love Donald Trump," Rampel said, as if anyone doubted this. Rampel said Trump's troubles in Palm Beach resulted from not going along with the gentleman's agreement. Rampel pointed to Mayor Paul Ilinski, Council President Leslie Smith, and Town Attorney John Randolph, and said they should step down from any further role in the hearings because they belonged to restricted clubs. To listen to this trash coming from you and Mr. Paul Rampel, frankly, is going to make me throw up, Mayor Ilinski told James Green, one of Trump's other lawyers. "Do so, sir," Green replied. "I may do so on you," said the mayor. America's leading authority on anti-Semitism, the Anti-Defamation League, ADL, was inevitably drawn into this high-profile squabble. The group asked Trump's lawyer to back up his allegations and gave him 2 weeks to submit the promised evidence. He did not. And Arthur Teitelbaum, the ADL's Southern Regional Director, issued a statement. "In our view, raising the specter of anti-Semitism without credible evidence is reckless and harmful to the entire community. Trump didn't seem to understand the danger involved in throwing out claims of anti-Semitism just to get his way. He took his case to Abraham Foxman, the ADL's national director. "Who the F is this guy? Teitelbaum," Trump asked. "Abe, it's anti-Semitism. All my members will be Jewish." "Donald, that's anti-Semitism," Foxman said. "You don't know who your members will be." Foxman was trying to explain to Trump that by saying that Gentiles would not want to be in a club with Jews, he was the one acting in a blatantly biased manner. By invoking anti-Semitism, Trump and his attorneys had put the town council in a position where it would be admitting to prejudice if it did away with the 11 stipulations. When the matter came to a vote in November, the council removed only 3 minor restrictions, leaving 8 intact. After all he went through with the town council, Rample just couldn't do it anymore. He went to Trump and said he would no longer be his lead lawyer. He no longer could live overwhelmed by Trumpian reality. Now from Mary Alice Miller comes this Vanity Fair spotlight, The Wheel Deal. Photographed by Micaiah Carter, on a roll, Sierra Hill, London Jennings, Stacy Gant, and Lawrence Keller, with their mother, Felicia Wright, at Holiday Skate Center in Orange, California. The Atlanta Jackknife, the St. Louis Ballroom, the Philly Fast Backwards. These roller skating styles evolved out of their respective cities with the help of hip-hop and custom wheels to form a transcontinental culture for black skaters who still encounter rinks that are segregated by insidious dress codes and music rules. And the culture is under threat. About 3 American rinks close every month, taking with them a gathering place and a sense of community. Felicia Wright says skating for her is like church. If you lose yourself in it, she says, you come out feeling brand new. Wright and her children are among the star subjects in United Skates, a new documentary by Diana Winkler and Tina Brown. The first time the director saw a stream of skaters performing Nutcrackers, a Chicago move characterized by a flip that lands in a split, they were compelled to tell the story of the community. Over 5 years, the filmmakers traveled across the country, slept on the floors of skaters' homes, and shot 500 hours of footage. The film, executive produced by John Legend, uses archival footage to chronicle skating's roots, from the civil rights era to a Queen Latifah show in the 80s, up to now, and features original interviews with artists such as Salt and Peppa. Skaters fought for access to this space, Winkler says, pointing out that the rink was a safe space for rival gangs. It's a story Winkler and Brown, from Hawaii and Australia, respectively, didn't initially feel was theirs to tell, but the community rallied behind them, quite literally. Brown says that she and Winkler learned how to film on skates, and Felicia actually pushed us from behind.
Thank you.
Meet the Markles. They're like a Monty Python sketch, said Megan's father about his new royal in-laws. I'm like, what is this, Joan Crawford speaking? Says Megan's half-sister. A slightly fractured, Americanized, Kardashianified royal fairy tale by Vanessa Grigoriadis. Opening photos, no rose without a thorn. Thomas Markle Sr. and his now estranged daughter, Meghan, in the early 90s, and Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex, at Royal Ascot last June. Meghan Markle will never, in all likelihood, be queen, but among the many benefits of marrying Prince Harry and becoming Duchess of Sussex is that she and Harry will have their own domain, a special relationship with the 53 Commonwealth countries, in many of which Meghan's mixed-race American background will be an asset. On her intricately planned 16-day tour of a few of these formerly colonized territories in the South Pacific, her first trip as an HRH, she ruled with her characteristic almost magical mix of micromanagement and moments of authenticity, exhibiting the type of spontaneous human interaction with which the royals have long struggled. In Sydney, she fell to her knees to greet a wheelchair-bound 98-year-old war widow, and in New Zealand, she directed underlings to distribute petit four to a passel of children in a town square. In Dubbo, New South Wales, she labored over a baked banana bread, then presented it to a family of fifth-generation farmers. She said if you go to someone's house, you always bring something. So she did, said the farmer's daughter, overwhelmed by the honor of eating princess bread. She said she was worried about the bananas, that she'd put too many bananas in it, except the Duke said there's never too many bananas. But when Meghan arrived at the University of the South Pacific in Suva, Fiji, this perfection was pierced. She was on hand to deliver a speech about the importance of funding girls' education, her clavicle swathed in a ceremonial necklace resembling a dozen calves' feet sprouting orange and pink peonies, and she proceeded with humanizing detail and flawless diction. As a university graduate, I know the personal feeling of pride and excitement that comes with attending university, she explained, her raven tresses gently pulled back from her face. It was through scholarships, financial aid programs, and work study where my earnings from a job on campus went directly towards my tuition that I was able to attend university, she continued, and without question, it was worth every effort. Within a day, a dissenting voice piped up from a world away, part of what has become Meghan's own personal chorus, her American family. Her half-sister, Samantha Markle, a 53-year-old blonde with MS who is confined to a wheelchair, began tapping out tweets, soon to be converted into headlines, insisting Dad paid for her college education. Samantha added, I love my sister, but this is ridiculous. She also called Meghan delusionally absurd. Even if she's not the monarchy's most important princess, this honor goes to the assiduously pleasant Kate Middleton, one day to be queen consort. Meghan is the princess of the moment, as transformational in her way as Princess Di. She is the only female self-made millionaire in the royal family, her fortune coming from her work on suits and on film. One of the oldest pregnant royals in a century, she's 37, and the first biracial person in a family of people who used to powder their faces to make themselves whiter. As a royal, she's not allowed to make political statements, but she's an acknowledged feminist who advocates for gay rights, and for her first charitable endeavor, she collaborated with the mostly Muslim survivors of the Grenfell fire. This soon-to-be mom to the first known biracial baby in the history of the monarchy represents the new and modern, all that America has given and will, if our politicians let us, continue to give to the world. She's like the 1% Gal Gadot. Even her gaffes are merely evidence that she's shaking up the royal family, which is dedicated to conservatism and self-perpetuation. When she refuses to wear nude-colored stockings to official events, as royals tend to, and goes bare-legged in the summer humidity, we cheer. When she closes her own car door instead of waiting for a valet, it's fraught with down-to-earth woman-of-the-people symbolism. Her public performance has been near flawless. She came from nowhere and reinvented the way the British royal family could behave. But of course, Meghan didn't come from nowhere exactly. She came from the American hinterland, from an aspirational, peripatetic, and yes, dysfunctional family, with whom she shares many traits, even if she sometimes seems to want to deny them. Where the British have generations of Plantagenets and Tudors, Americans have Jay Gatsby, a man who loved clothes as much as any princess. I've never seen such beautiful shirts before, and a past he liked to keep hidden. Meghan isn't Gatsby exactly. She hasn't expunged her background, but there's something of Fitzgerald's anti-hero in Meghan's preternatural American reinvention. She comes from a family of acolytes, of motivational speakers, and reality shows. Tony Robbins and the Kardashians are touchstones. People who believe that the future doesn't at all have to be governed by the past. According to a Hollywood source, when her star was rising, she threw herself a party at her home, unofficially billed as a Sayonara Zara party. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.